have urged him to keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan past the deadline, but others warn that breaking the deal could spark a renewed U.S.-Taliban war. If the U.S.-led war effort drags on, the massive waste of resources will likely continue with it. My view is it's impossible to imagine a war in Afghanistan, even a successful one, that doesn't waste much of its budget, says Ben Friedman, Policy Director of Defense Priorities. He added, the problem is that even the unwasted money is throwing good after bad.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Halfway. On this week's show, we'll be looking at just how Wall Street traders were once again rocked by yet another financial crisis. When it comes to stocks and shares, there's no greater global name than the famous New York Stock Exchange. Of course, that's located on Wall Street, if you didn't know. Now, it comes down to one thing when it comes to Wall Street and the New York Stock Exchange, and that's the movement of money. That's how people make their money. Some make a lot of money, and some lose a lot of money. But more recently, markets and great legacies of the stock market have been hit by everyday traders using an online chat forum called Reddit. It was used to manipulate stocks and shares, with the most obvious one hitting recent headlines being the GameStop squeeze, which saw the tiny company's price rise by over 1,700%. Now, the Reddit group was influenced by one particular thread, namely the Wall Street Bets page, which was designed to share tips and information about which shares and stocks to buy, and hence saw the phenomenon blow out of all proportions. That demonstrates just how fast the group went from under 1 million subscribers to over 5 million almost overnight. Let's therefore take a look at our first report that delves into the events that saw many individuals gain reasonably large sums of money, whilst investors and brokers of Wall Street could only stand by and watch as they lost billions.
Back in 2012, a Reddit page was born and was named r/WallStreetBets, a simple page that openly discussed tips and tricks as to buying and selling shares for the small-time investor. At the time, nobody would have known that one day the chat forum would spark a crisis that would cost Wall Street billions of dollars. 2021, struggling video game store GameStop suddenly became the center of attention as users of the Reddit group used the forum to encourage each other to buy stocks of the company, which in turn sent the price of the shares of GameStop through the roof. Much to the dismay of the hedge fund investors who had bet against the price rising as the company was slipping into administration.
It's very reminiscent of 1999 and the dot-com era, because does GameStop really have a valuation of $160 a share per stock or $100? Absolutely not. But, you know, there are people out there that are, you know, are trading and speculating, and, you know, that's why they're pushing these stocks up higher. And it's kind of, you know, this is a little scary for retail investors who don't have the right knowledge on how to invest, or even, and I don't even call it investing, it's really kind of speculating in these types of stocks.
The sudden surge in price forced institutional investors into buying back stock that they had bet against, obviously at a much higher price, hence leaving them very much out of pocket in a process known in the trade as a short squeeze.
You've had an explosion of the average Joe, so to speak, citizens getting involved in aspects of day trading. And one of the things that was the way that it was presented initially in terms of the GameStop situation in general, of the dramatic rise of the stock value and so forth, there were other companies that were involved in this, were through social media platforms, were people teaming up as a means to then stick it to Wall Street.
Such was the popularity of the Wall Street Bets page that its subscribers shot up from 3 million members in January 2021 to over 8 million in early February, showing that with such large numbers of people all buying the same stock at the same time, the manipulation of the market performed took even the most professional stock traders by surprise. One of the main platforms for buying and selling shares on a small scale was the Robinhood app. However, such was the lobbying pressure on them by the corridors of power in Wall Street and other financial institutions that they were forced to step in, they blocked transactions involving GameStop, which by now had seen prices of shares rise by 140%.
I'm pleased to say that joining me in the studio is Current Affairs and Impact Analyst Mahan Abedin. Welcome.
Thank you.
As well as Larry Bridwell. He's the Professor of International Business at Pace University. Okay, welcome to you both. First to you, Professor. We're looking at amateur investors who organized over Reddit and other online forums, targeted shares of companies, including GameStop, that have been short-sold by these hedge funds. Now, that is how this is reported. But that may be very hard for the average viewer to actually understand. Can you please explain this to us in layman terms, if you can, please?
Well, the controversy is on the little people in the stock market who they believe that when they couldn't buy GameStop because of Robinhood, that the big hedge funds had stepped on the little people. And this has attracted an enormous media attention. And what had happened is that the big hedge funds had shorted the stock, GameStop, because they assumed it was going to go down, so they made bets for it to go down. And then there was, and this is an example of social media, there was a chat room that a lot of young people had shopped at GameStop. And so they thought that it had a good future, and they were talking about when they used to visit it and the games they used to buy, etc. So they started buying the stock, and then that created all kinds of problems for those hedge funds that had shorted it. And then Robinhood stopped receiving orders, and the whole thing crashed, and that started the whole process of the Wall Street hurting the average little investor.
All right. Obviously, still kind of difficult to understand what has happened. But Mahan, this is an unprecedented example based on what we have seen unfold, how the general public has been actually able to shake an establishment and powerful institution to the core. Do you think such examples will be seen again in the future? Is it going to happen again? Or will the powers that be that are within Wall Street and other global stock exchanges actually take action to make sure that repeat doesn't happen?
Well, I think it can happen again, and because your guess is quite right. You know, the establishment in Wall Street and its allies across the financial banking sector are very strong. But look, social media is a powerful tool, and the GameStop Reddit saga has demonstrated that. Reddit really is very powerful in terms of how it can manipulate user public opinion, how it can coalesce people who are otherwise very disparate in their thinking and in their attitudes, can bring them together.
Okay, we're going to now take a look at another part of this whole saga that has unfolded in terms of what has been said. The saga got the attention of U.S. lawmakers. Now, mind you, we didn't really hear about the SEC. That's the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. That's a large independent agency of the U.S. federal government that was created to follow the stock market crash in the 1920s and to protect investors and the national banking system. But that didn't happen. But we heard from U.S. lawmakers get involved rather pretty quickly, as you're about to see.
It did not take long for the saga to turn political when lawmakers from both sides of the spectrum in the U.S. joined the debate, with some saying that by placing restrictions on the buying and selling of stock was unacceptable.
But if removing the revenues that you make from a payment for order flow would cause the removal of free commissions, doesn't that mean that trading on Robinhood isn't actually free to begin with? Because you're just hiding the cost in terms of potentially poor execution or the cost of lost rebates to your customers.
Does Citadel's lobbyist right now been hired to oppose federal proposals to financial transaction tax because it would make high-frequency trading less profitable?
I want to know how each of the witnesses here today and the companies they represent contributed to the historic trading events in January.
Americans are far more sophisticated, informed, and capable than folks in D.C. give them credit for. And it's time our securities laws treat them that way.
Back with me in the studio is Mahan Abedin and Larry Bridwell. Welcome back to you both. Larry, when it comes down to it, one issue is at hand, and that's it, is whether Robinhood actually conspired with the big Wall Street hedge funds, as it was reported, to screw over the everyday folks who are suddenly striking it rich with investments like GameStop.
Well, this is almost like a courtroom drama, because Robinhood's a relatively new company. They had not anticipated. This is what the argument they're making, and all of a sudden they get all these orders, and they didn't have the capital. So it took them a couple of days to get the capital. Now, the CEO of Robinhood saying, I'm just an innocent victim of circumstances. And then other people are saying, well, you have this linkage with the hedge funds. So I think we're going to have kind of a courtroom-type hearing to find out what the real story is. But there is speculation that Robinhood had colluded with the hedge funds, but the CEO denies this. So we'll have to find out what the investigations find out.
Yeah, indeed. Well, hopefully there's going to be some conclusion to that.
Yeah.
Mahan, it's been known that Wall Street, which is comprised of these hedge funds and money managers, they don't really care about the everyday people, do they, in terms of the type of trading they do? I mean, we could take a look at the 2008 financial crisis, how that unfolded. Why doesn't the Fed or the law reel in these shady practices instead of just fining them? It seems like they're good at fining them. They pay the fine, these whatever entities you want to call them, and then they move on with business as usual.
But fining is the default punishment for these type of crimes in the United States. And what tends to happen, of course, is that the American regulators, they impose very, very hefty fines on international transgressors. You've seen that in the fines they impose on banks, for instance, who've assisted countries or individuals under sanction to evade sanctions. The fines can be astronomical. They're really crippling. But in terms of the actual U.S. market, no, the fines are not very harsh. And this goes, I mean, I think your question goes into the heart of the matter. If these are criminal acts, I think everybody agrees that they are, and they can be very damaging, why aren't people going to jail for it?
Indeed. Yeah, I agree with that. Well, now is a good time to take a look at some of the protests that actually took place on what many see as Wall Street watching out for number one, namely themselves, while the average Joe is the one that suffers the losses.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're called Robin Hood, right? So, yeah, it's kind of ironic that they're helping the big guys.
It's pretty crazy because I think, I mean, I look at the whole GameStop thing with the stocks as a Revenge of the Nerds kind of attack on the big boys in Wall Street and against a lot of the big, big trading firms that are out there.
I think the little man finally got an ounce of what they deserve, and it was the assholes in there that took it from them. They delisted it. Ameritrade, Robinhood, Webull, they all can't stand to have the little guy win, and that pissed me off. And that's why it's the suits, it's buy Bitcoin, and it's always been that for decades. It shows you that you can be your own bank, you can do your own transactions, verifiable, permissionless, decentralized. It's the future of commerce, and the assholes in there, they haven't caught on to it yet, but Grayscale, Michael Saylor, MicroStrategy, they're starting to dip their feet in, and this is the future of finance right here.
Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kaveh Tahwaib. It's time now to take a look at some of the other economic headlines hitting the front pages in our info news section. Our first story takes us to the aviation industry. where the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic is still taking its toll. Orders for new aircraft all but dried up in January, as just four commercial aircraft orders were placed, down from some 296 that were placed back in January of 2020. Adding insult to injury, all four planes ordered were freight types. That shows just how bad the industry is suffering. But it seems that each week there is no escaping the fortunes of the cryptocurrency Bitcoin, which has once again smashed records by surpassing the $58,000 mark. As of the recording of this show, the value has now risen more than 90% since the start of January, pushing its total market value to above $1 trillion. Mind you, again, as of the recording of this show, prices have actually come down. There's been about 20% drop. Next story, the Institute of International Finance has estimated that the COVID-19 outbreak added to global debt, with the figure soaring to an all-time high of $281 trillion. The debt-to-GDP ratio increased by 35 percentage points to 356%. Estimates suggest that another $10 trillion will be added to this figure by the end of the year. And finally, ties between the EU and Russia are hitting lows on both a political and an economic level, with the EU's largest powerhouse, Germany, reporting that trade is down with Russia. Business is down 22% year-on-year to $44.9 billion, with German exports to Russia down 13.1% and Russian imports to Germany down 29.9%. Okay, make sure to watch our upcoming episode of Economic Divide, where we cover the EU-Russia relationship in more detail. Well, it's time now to take a look at our final report of the day, as we examine how traders are looking at alternative forms of investment outside the normal realms of the stock market.
The 1980s brought a period of global capitalism that saw the birth of the get-rich-quick ideology, with bankers, investors, realtors, and traders making the most of the boom days. But this was not limited to and restricted to just the personal working for the big banks and stock exchanges around the world. Everyday people also wanted to make money, and so the birth of home enterprise was witnessed, with people starting to invest in small ventures, ranging from buying and selling vehicles, cosmetics, and a host of other things. With the world able to now obtain information in real time, much like the decline of travel agencies as people book their holidays at home online, the GameStop saga could also be the birth of a decline in stock exchanges, with everyone now aware of just how easy it is to invest their money.
I think certainly it appears that, you know, the regulators are certainly taking a look, as they've said publicly, on, you know, the recent market action. It's hard to say whether additional regulations would be required. Certainly, again, from my vantage point, you know, really it's about making sure that the playing field is level.
Welcome back to the studio, current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin and Larry Bridwell, professor of international business at Pace University. Larry, on a deeper level, doesn't this whole affair show how manipulation happens on Wall Street? You're looking at manipulation that is pretty deep, from insider trading, artificial price inflation, just to name a couple. How deep is this manipulation that's happening on Wall Street, do you think?
This is a major issue, and it's especially accentuated by this phenomenon called private equity. And the 500 companies went from being public, where you buy and sell the stocks, to being private, so it's no longer in the stock market. And of those 500 companies, over a 20-year period, 20% of them went bankrupt. And in the public companies, it was only 2%. So these private equity firms, as part of the stock market manipulation, they take the cash out of the companies, and that makes them weaker. And there are some prominent examples of this. There was this famous toy company for children in the United States called Toys R Us. They were taken private, went bankrupt. Two of the largest retailers in the history of the United States, called Sears and Kmart, also went bankrupt when they were taken private. And even the Hertz Rent-A-Car went into bankruptcy. So this is one of the reasons why Senator Elizabeth Warren is pushing this Accountable Capitalism Act, because if you had to, for a big company, it had to be $1 billion, not a little company, a big company, if you have 40% of the board of directors be employees, then you can fight that.
Okay, I want to thank Larry Bridwell there. He's a professor of international business at Pace University. Mahan, final question here. We've seen how the Reddit phenomenon has caused everyday people to buy and sell stocks.
Yeah.
How do you think people are faring when it comes to alternative markets? We're seeing, for example, what has happened in the cryptocurrency market with, let's say, Bitcoin and the likes. Prices have soared.
Yeah.
Do you think similar examples are out there as we have witnessed with the Reddit saga?
Well, you know, events like this can create the illusion that this can gain real traction. My personal view is that this is still an outlier. It's a fringe event. And yes, there are equivalents of it in all walks of life, even in politics. Look, the New Zealand, the Australian terrorist who killed all those people in New Zealand back in 2019, he was the member of this alternative chatting forum called Chan, which is quite similar to Reddit, but it has a political content, whereas, you know, Reddit is about social stuff and, you know, it's kind of a different category. But yet, you know, examples are out there where forums like Reddit or its equivalent in the political world can manipulate public opinion on certain issues and then create a very spectacular event. But it's still an outlier. You know, it's not affecting public opinion writ large.
Okay, so thank you very much for that. We appreciate
you're
it. Mahan Abedin, Current Affairs and Impact Analyst, many thanks for your thoughts. Now, you also thank Larry Bridwell also for being with us. Now, our other guest in the program, the one we featured in our reports, he gave a really good example of how Wall Street manipulates the average person. Let's hear him as to how that happens in his own words.
One other example of how this is actually looks structurally, take the case of BlackRock Incorporated, right? The largest asset manager that, together with the other of the big three, State Street and Vanguard, together they have about $18 trillion of assets under their management. I think that's larger than the nation of China itself, the second largest economy on the planet. And the way that BlackRock sort of rose to its prominence was through this, what was called Aladdin. That stands for Asset Liability Debt and Derivative Investments Network. That's about 6,000 super high-tech computers all pooled together with a team of about 2,000 IT specialists, mathematicians. It was actually, I believe, a joint venture with Google to be able to run these, for the asset managers, run these kind of passive management versus these, having traders that are involved in sort of active trading processes. Instead, you let the computers run it, and it's a much more lucrative system for the likes of BlackRock. I guarantee those types of systems would be integrated with social media such that these kind of operations that you're seeing in the case of GameStop and the Robinhood controversy in general, I guarantee that that just gives an indication of how things are lined up at Wall Street, which is designed to fleece your everyday citizen, your common investor. That's how the mafia works, and certainly that's how these guys operate as well.
So this is a bit more complicated and controlling than what many perceive the stock market to be. But ultimately, the market manipulation comes in many different forms that blurs the lines of whether the investments in a stock is based on real facts or not. The world we live in is becoming smaller and is operating ever more on a real-time basis, with the world able to connect and trade at the click of a button from the comfort of an armchair at home. Yet for decades, and even maybe centuries, certain niche markets were dominated by the powerhouses in the corridors of stock exchanges around the world. Yet the Reddit movement, which saw everyday traders rock the world of the hedge fund managers and everyday bankers, demonstrated that the wolf of Wall Street has now turned into a pack. Yet the pack has changed from the elite traders into everyday people, something that cost billions and put many noses out of joint. Already laws and measures are being taken to avoid a repeat of the GameStop saga. But will manipulating the law to favor the stock markets simply motivate the many to find new and more adventurous ways to break the system? Only time will tell. That's about all the time we have on this week's episode. So on behalf of myself, Kovit Halfway, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Second phase of the revolution. Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. One of the issues that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has emphasized for boosting production is increasing production of protein with marine base. Elaborating on the motto of the year, Leap in Production, he said, production, besides being vital for the economy of country, has a lot of political, social, and cultural impacts in a way that the ability of a nation to produce its basic needs will give it self-confidence and a sense of dignity, and will set the ground for public welfare, increase gross domestic production, GDP, and exports, and it will have cultural effects in the goods that are exported to other countries. Mahmoud Bahmani, an official in Iran's fishery, says that development of fishery can both decrease freshwater consumption and remarkably boost the production of aquatics. Teaching important points in raising and management of farms for production of shrimp, seaweed, and other aquatic plants are among the duties of the Institute of Research of Fishery Sciences. In view of this, breed reformation of trout, kipper, shrimp, and also culturing tilapia have been put on the agenda of the Institute. Tilapia, due to growing much good taste, having fewer bones, cheapness, adaptability to different climates, having no need to fresh water, being economical and growing in a short time, has attracted many traders. That's why more than 140 countries have planned for production of this fish, and the financial circulation of this fish has topped $5 billion. Experts believe that Iran has the potential to produce 1 million tons of fish artificially per year. This is called production in cage. It means to use seawater for production of fish on land. Iran has also started to produce some species of sturgeon for production of caviar since a few years ago. These species are now being raised and exported to foreign markets. The city of Astara in northern province of Gilan is the main hub of fish in the country. As for the production of sturgeon, the Iranian fishery has set 20% growth compared to the previous year. Purkazemi, a former official of the institute, said, according to the statistics of Iran's fishery organization, more than 140,000 tons of trout is produced in the country, which puts Iran on the first global rank in terms of trout production in freshwater. Healthy nourishment is one of the aspects of healthy life, and consumption of aquatics is an important index in this respect. The World Health Organization, WHO, referring to the key impact of aquatics on human health and prevention of various diseases, recommends the consumption of these foods twice a week. The per capita consumption of aquatics in the world is 20 kilograms per year. The figure in Iran is nearly half. In 2019, Iran exported over 120,000 tons of aquatics with a value of approximately $400 million, and the trade balance of the fishery remained positive. As for raising shrimp, according to the sixth development plan, Iran was supposed to produce 46,000 tons of shrimp, while the country produced 10% more than the figure. Regarding the fish of cold waters, good measures have been taken for production of high-quality trout. Thus, it is estimated that nearly 170,000 tons of cold water and 130,000 tons of warm water fish will be produced. The production of marine food products and self-sufficiency in this field with scientific methods can help lead in production. This becomes more important when one pays attention to the economic objectives of enemies of the Iranian nation. Therefore, every effort in the path of leap in production will reduce vulnerability in the face of pressures and will turn weak points to privileges and strong points. This will eventually cause immunity against threats and conspiracies.
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S. and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe, as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
If the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased, and they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years. The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the UN body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back, and I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said the bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue. Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, the essence of anti-Semitism. President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
The recent coup in Myanmar has taken the time back to 1962. When the military took control of the Southeast Asian country 14 years after its independence from Britain. Since then, the stage was set for military's power play until 2011, when Myanmar underwent democratic reforms and began parliamentary elections. The military junta seized power on February 1 and declared a one-year-long state of emergency after detaining the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her National League for Democracy Party, among other elected government officials. The military claimed that the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. However, the Election Commission nullified this claim, stating that there was no evidence. While the ousted leader is under house arrest, military commander-in-chief Ming Aung Hlaing has taken power. Despite public opposition, he attempted to justify the takeover by saying the military is on the people's side and would form a true and disciplined democracy. That is while the military junta says it wants to hold a free and fair election once the state of emergency is over. However, the country has lapsed into chaos since February 1 coup, sparking daily mass protests as well as global condemnation. The U.S. and the European Union are weighing up imposing sanctions against the junta leaders. The U.S. already has imposed some sanctions against some of the major junta leaders. Nonetheless, the military has ignored the international outcry and responded to the public opposition with escalating force. So far, 50 people have been killed and hundreds arrested during the military junta's lethal crackdown on nationwide anti-coup protests. Wednesday marked Myanmar's bloodiest day since the military takeover. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar confirmed that 38 people lost their lives after security forces opened fire on protesters demanding the return of civilian rule in the country.
Well, I guess nobody knows why, but my speculation is that they are the ones who hold on to the power at this moment, and they are very motivated by having the power, whether economically or running the country. So now, because they are taking over the country by force, and nobody wants to have the military run the country, and therefore people are standing up for their rights, and that is exactly what the dictators, the Burmese government junta, doesn't want it.
Since the deadly military crackdown on the Rohingya Muslims in 2017, Aung San Suu Kyi's government has faced international condemnations. Following that, the West's interest in Myanmar has faded, and now with the military coup and the bloody crackdown on demonstrators, Myanmar is further alienating itself from the West. Moreover, as a Southeast Asian country is currently grappling with the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic and the military coup on its economy, the U.S. and the European Union are considering imposing sanctions. That could worsen the current crisis in Myanmar and push it into an ally's corner, namely China. The U.S. has already placed sanctions on Myanmar and has condemned the junta leader's harsh crackdown on the protesters. Moreover, the EU has also come out and condemned Myanmar's military, suspending development funds for the country. Yet what is interesting is how the Southeast Asian nations have so far rebuffed U.S. sanctions, which, in their words, has given the generals a lifeline.
The most important thing that we also need to understand is that Burma is one of the countries where China invests most. So, for example, we're talking about the projects that are linked to the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, which is part of the Beijing Big Belt Road Initiative that loop together a series of strategic ports, railways, and pipelines across the globe.
No Asian country has come out supporting the sanctions and anti-Myanmar actions. In this instance, China can therefore benefit economically from Myanmar, as trade with the West is now restricted.
The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region. Biden came into office amid rising anti-American sentiments in Iraq and growing calls on Washington to pull out all American forces from Iraq. Biden's team is now faced with growing attacks on American and U.S.-led foreign forces there. Does the problem have a military solution? Despite Biden's promises of change, the White House must still be thinking that it does. Because last week, Biden ordered airstrikes on anti-Daesh resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border in what his team described as a retaliation for earlier rocket attacks against American and U.S.-led forces. The U.S. airstrikes drew condemnation from resistance fighters and pledges of retaliation. On Wednesday, a barrage of rockets was fired at the Ain al-Assad Air Base, housing American troops in Iraq's western Anbar province. Advanced air defense systems at the Ain al-Assad Air Base failed to intercept the incoming rockets. Some observers believe the aerial bombardment ordered by Biden has backfired and has made U.S. forces in the region less safe.
It backfired because it was despicable and
This was seen throughout the region. Everyone sees that America's just dumping its garbage on other people's heads. So it's very, very bad for the whole region, if in America's terms, because it increases anti-American sentiment everywhere.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. Anti-Americanism in Iraq was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attack on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces.
The Iraqi parliamentarians almost unanimously voted to expel all U.S. troops, period. And, of course, nothing has been done on that. So if a year ago the sentiment was like that, then it's only increasing. America is the enemy. America doesn't seem to get it through its head how it's perceived in Iraq and Afghanistan, wherever in the world.
But America is still refusing to heed to that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safe, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, Trump withdrew several hundreds of U.S. troops from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there, despite his pledge to end American military presence in the region. How will Biden deal with the situation now? Observers believe by ordering the recent aerial bombardment on the Iraqi-Syrian border, he definitely had a bad start. If Biden stays on the same dangerous course, he risks further destabilizing Iraq and broader clashes with resistance groups.
Yemen has recently been the scene of deadly clashes between Ansarullah fighters and forces loyal to the former president's Abu Rabah Mansur Hadi, who aimed to capture the strategic northern city of Ma'arib. The fighting left at least 60 people dead on both sides Saturday. This after army forces and allied fighters continued with their push towards the oil-rich city, Hadi's last urban stronghold in Yemen, which is some 120 kilometers east of the capital Sana'a. Reports said that a high-ranking pro-Hadi military commander from Ma'arib's provincial military police also got killed. But last Friday was the bloodiest day since the start of the offensive on February 8. More than 60 people died in that fighting. Reports said the dead included at least 27 pro-Hadi militias. Meanwhile, on Saturday, several civilians, including a child, got killed in a Saudi-led airstrike in Yemen's western province of Hodeidah. The Yemeni media said that a drone raid targeted a residential building in the city of Hodeidah, also injuring several others.
The war being waged by the Saudi royal family against the people of Yemen, which is the poorest country in the Arab world, is an illegal war. It's a war of aggression, and it's also illegal in the targets that it takes in Yemen. 233,000 people are reported to have been killed. These are civilians who have been killed by Saudi air attacks. And a child dies every 10 minutes, according to UNICEF, in Yemen due to hunger and to lack of medications. And that's because the Saudis are illegally blocking aid coming into the port of Hodeidah. So everything about this war is illegal.
The attack comes as the 6th anniversary of the Saudi invasion of Yemen is near. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions. It has also reduced to rubble much of Yemen's infrastructure. The United Nations has described the situation as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN's humanitarian agency has warned that more than 16 million people in Yemen will go hungry this year as Saudi Arabia presses ahead with this notorious war. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that 500,000 Yemenis are already living in famine-like conditions. It said the risk of large-scale famine has never been more acute than now. According to the agency, years of conflict have created enormous humanitarian needs in all sectors.
The famine caused by the Saudi war on Yemen is part of the illegality of the war in general. It's been caused because the Saudis have been blockading the ports of Yemen, especially Hodeidah, and preventing international aid from coming in, aid that has been mandated through the United Nations and agreed to by the parties at international conferences. But that doesn't stop the Saudi coalition from trying to starve the people of Yemen into submission.
The UN says that at least 60% of Yemenis are food insecure, and 16 million people do not have access to safe water and proper sanitation. The war impact, compounded by the blockade and the coronavirus pandemic, has battered Yemenis. But all of this would not have happened from the beginning if the U.S. and its allies had not provided logistical military support and military hardware to Saudi Arabia.
It's shameful that the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France, Italy, and other countries have been selling large amounts of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the UAE. These arms have allowed the Saudi coalition to wage this illegal war on the people of Yemen and to cause widespread death and famine.
The Biden administration says it plans to stop arms sales to the Saudis and to stop supporting their war in Yemen. Many would consider this move as too little too late, because Riyadh has already packed its arsenal with huge quantities of arms that it bought from the previous administration and other Western governments, especially the UK. But almost 6 years into the war, the Saudis are facing an impasse as they have not made any significant gains on the battlefield. They have suffered many humiliating blows from the Yemenis who, unlike their enemy, have stood their ground. The latest attack on Riyadh is one example. What the people of Yemen want to see at a minimum is a meaningful move by the West and the UN to effectively end this war that will go down in history as a war in which the U.S. backed the Saudi-led coalition and committed war crimes in that country.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Introducing personalities who were influential in the affairs of the country. A very important point is that Tabriz and Azerbaijan has always had two permanent and eternal qualities and identities. One is deep attachment to Islam and to Islamic piety, and the second is strong zeal for Iran. These two qualities have always existed in Azerbaijan in different eras. They have attached so much significance to Islam and Iran. This is a really important quality. The people of Azerbaijan have always stood up against those foreigners who wanted to dismember various parts of Iran in that region, and they managed to preserve the country's integrity.
Your light and love, all I see, your thing or I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Another characteristic is the important role played by outstanding personalities. There are many personalities in this area who played a leading role in all the matters of the country. As I mentioned, in the event of tobacco, the late Haji Mirza Jawad played an important role. In the beginning of the constitutional movement, Sattar Khan and Baqir Khan. Baqir Khan lived in the same neighborhood as my father, and my father knew him in the Khiaban neighborhood, played a prominent role. And in another era, when the Russians had entered Tabriz and were present there, the late Saqatul Islam Tabrizi and other great ulama fought and were martyred. Yet in another era, Sheikh Muhammad Khiabani and Mirza Ismail Nubari entered the arena and did certain activities that led to the martyrdom of Khiabani. And during revolutionary activities, when the movement began in the year 1342, there were three well-known ulama from Tabriz among the ulama who had been arrested by the regime. Later on, during various events on days close to the revolution, we witnessed the move made by the late Qazi Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Ali Qazi Tabatabahi and others. After the revolution, we witnessed the activities of Shahid Madani and Shahid Qazi, and during the Sacred Defense era, the activities of Shahid Bakiri. There are tens of such outstanding personalities who played an important role.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
Yemenis talk together in front of the UN office in Sana'a to slam the UN donor conference and renew their calls on the international organization and the international community to end the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We hope that they will talk about the ships of oil derivatives at the donors' conference. The Yemeni people need fuel just as they need food and medicine. There are thousands of trucks carrying aid that are parked in and could not reach the Yemenis because of the lack of fuel. We want serious action from the United Nations to release oil ships.
Protesters described the UN donor conference as a historical farce. Yemenis said the detained oil vessels must be released and the Saudi war as well as the blockade of Yemen must be stopped.
The donors conference is nothing more than a historical farce.
We do not need humanitarian aid, but rather to lift the blockade and release oil ships.
The Yemenis do not need a donor conference as much as they need.